High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org, I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to follow the science on marijuana. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. There is no safe drug supply unless it comes from a legal pharmacy. If you are around anyone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a hopeful conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Hope. That is what gets people to think about the future and good things. We need hope every day when we get up in the morning and face the day. We especially need hope when things are not going so well. Hope helps us get through life's challenges and adversities. There is a city of hope for people with cancer. My friend Sherry Rubin started a nonprofit called Hope Together to educate people about the dangers of prescription opioids after her son overdosed. And there are foundations with the word hope in them for a lot of things, for cancer and drugs, homelessness, hunger, abuse, violence, animals, children, and more. Where do you go and find hope when things are really bad? Let's find out. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hello, Dr. Lev. This is Lisa Wallace. I am a registered nurse and currently work as an operations supervisor for Scripps Health. You and I have worked together now for many years, in fact, over two decades, and we've experienced and lived through many of life's adverse and tragic events working together in the ER. I'd like to thank you for High Truths, a wonderful podcast, and your dedication and work on eradicating needless drug deaths. Also, thank you to your great producer, Dave Rivas. Your listeners may not know that Dave was an EMT and a 911 dispatcher in the city of San Diego for many years. Additionally, he is a voice actor and sound producer. Dave and I worked together in the early 90s. Hello, Dave.
Dr. Lev, I wanted to ask, is there hope for people with severe substance abuse and addiction?
Thank you, Lisa, for your question and a very fun shout out to our producer, Dave Rivas. Dave is a very special and talented individual. I am indeed very, very fortunate and blessed to have him as producer for High Truths. To answer your question about hope for addiction, I invited an expert who struggled with addiction, crime, and yet is an inspiration for hope. Frank Kinsako Saragosa, who goes by Ken, was a college professor in American literature whose addiction to drugs led him to the bottom, to Skid Row, homelessness, and a convicted felon sitting in prison. How's that redeemable? Where was his hope? While incarcerated, he won first place in a writing competition against 800 other submissions. He didn't even find out about his win until after he was out. I promise you, you will be inspired to listen to Ken and have a better understanding of the power of addiction through his story. To learn more about Ken Saragosa, please check out the High Truth show notes. Ken Saragosa, welcome to High Truth.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me today.
And I was really inspired when I heard your story with the Center Community Research and the Healthcare Task Force of San Diego. I really wanted the rest of the world to hear it. It's very inspiring. You've have a long, interesting journey and have a lot of good life lessons through that. So I thought that you can start with childhood. You were as a child, I had a lot of ambition. People called you Professor.
That was my nickname in high school, yeah.
So you didn't have exposure or tendency or family history of drugs, or how was your childhood?
So my father is Mexican American. He was born in California, and he went into the Air Force. He was really good in school. He was the valedictorian of his high school class. I think in a different generation, he would have been, a Mexican American who is academically excellent would have been recruited to go to schools. But in the 50s, that wasn't happening. And his family couldn't afford to send him to college. So he joined the military, and he met my mother in Japan. They moved, and he was in the Air Force. So we went to different places, but we finally landed in Omaha, Nebraska. And that's where my father ultimately retired. So I spent most of my childhood growing up in Omaha, in the 70s and early 80s. And so, I have a family, which is a practicing Buddhist household, Mexican and Japanese in Nebraska. And so I felt, I had a wonderful home. I had parents who loved me and who worked really hard to make sure that I had every opportunity they could give me. And making them proud was really important to me. So I did really well in school. I didn't curse. I did not miss a day of school from kindergarten until the day I graduated from high school. Did not miss a day of school. So
that's
because
big.
Yeah, well, both of my parents valued education a lot. And yeah, you're right. My high school nickname was the Professor. And it's no surprise that I became a college professor at one point. But if you had asked anybody in my high school graduating class who was most likely to become homeless, live on the streets, go to prison, and become a serious drug addict, I don't think anybody would have guessed me.
When we think about people who have a serious substance use disorder, we talk about ACEs, adverse childhood events. Did you have any adverse childhood events?
I will say, so some of it is a little bit personal. I did have some sexual abuse, not in my family, in the neighborhood. I'd rather not go into the details, but so I was sexualized at a young age. And also because of the racial and cultural differences, when I was younger, especially like early elementary school, I was beaten up and bullied. That didn't last into high school. Like by the time I was in high school, my high school experience was great. But early on, when I was quite young, it was an interesting thing. On the one hand, to have a home where I felt so safe, and then to go into a world where I felt, really alone. And one of the most difficult parts was, I remember one time I came home and I had been beaten up and attacked by some of the other kids. And so I came home and I looked a mess. And my mother was really concerned and she wanted to know what happened, but I couldn't tell her because in essence, they beat me up because I was her child. I was 7 or 8, but I didn't have the vocabulary to tell her why they did it in a way that she wouldn't take it to be her fault. My mother was always really concerned that because of her, I would have unnecessary difficulties. She felt that a teacher told her when I was, I think, 5 or 6, I had a speech impediment. And so I was very shy and didn't speak in class because kids would laugh whenever I spoke. But they told her it was because she spoke Japanese as her native language, and that because her English was broken, that's the word they called it, broken English, that I was having trouble in school. And you couldn't have said something more painful to my mother. And so she actually, even though she is not a native speaker of English, she tried to figure out how she could help me do better in school. So she heard that if you read to your child, that will help. So she started reading me children's books, even though she couldn't read necessarily all the words. So she had a Japanese English dictionary. And then she would read the books. And then at some point, I actually read pretty well, even as a young boy. So at some point, I would help her read. And then our ritual became me reading to her every night. So she would tuck me in and then I would read the children's book to her. So yeah, but that's just an example of, you know, on the one hand, my home life was very discordant with my life outside of the home.
And there was no, the other risk factors for when you look at people's lives who have become having a substance use disorder is a family history of addiction. So on either side of the family, did you have?
So my mother was orphaned. I know my mother didn't, like if she had half a glass of wine, she was loopy. And so she preferred not to drink. And my mother was orphaned. So I have no idea of the family history on that side. On my father's side, it turns out there's a fair bit of substance abuse history. Not in my father, but on that side of the family, mm-hmm. there was a lot of substance abuse, including, I didn't know this until much later, much into my adulthood, but I am not the first person in my family to go to prison. It turns out other people in my extended family have been to prison, and that some of them were actually named Ken. So the joke in that side of the family was, if you have a male child, don't name him Ken.
Yeah, that's a risk factor, right?
Yes, exactly.
Again. Yeah. So you did well. You were a good student, never missed a day of school, went to college, became a professor in literature. That's pretty heavy duty. Yeah. When were you first exposed to drugs?
Well, I had my first drink after I graduated from high school. That was, you know, in retrospect, I was with some other people and I'd never had a drink before. And I remember drinking all of a sudden. I don't know if you remember those old cartoons of Popeye when he would pop a can of spinach and then all of a sudden he would puff up, you know. Exactly. That's exactly what drinking felt like to me. All of a sudden, I was confident. I was funny. I could interact easily with other people. I felt like one of the guys. And I don't know, for me, I always felt out of place, awkward, and not included. And so that feeling of connection and belonging was what alcohol first and then drugs later gave me. It's a lie, of course, because I was so well connected that I ended up alone on the streets, severing ties with everybody who ever loved me. But at least initially, that was the thing it gave me. You know, that first night I drank to blackout. I didn't even know what a blackout was.
The first time you drank, you blacked out?
I did, yeah. I thought, when I heard the phrase blackout, I thought it meant you passed out. And I never passed out, I just fell asleep. But I didn't understand till later that blacking out means that you drink so much you don't remember what happened, that you're functioning, you just don't know what you're doing. And that happened frequently in my drinking career. And I thought if people didn't do that, that they didn't know how to have a good time. I thought that was just a normal part of drinking. And so clearly, in retrospect, I can see I was drinking alcoholically almost from the very beginning, you know? Later on, I didn't try drugs until into my late 20s. I was in graduate school in Philadelphia the first time I ever tried cocaine. And I was 34 years old and a professor at a university in Orange County when I first tried crystal meth.
Well, so what about marijuana?
You know, I've never, I think I may have smoked it once or twice in college. I never liked it. It turns out as an adult, I found out I have attention deficit disorder. I think the way my brain works, I'm more inclined toward the stimulants. So cocaine and speed are the drugs that, you know, are the ones that I'm attracted to. Anything that brings me down isn't so enjoyable to me.
So I'm wondering if you do have a genetic component to your addiction where you had that first drink and boom, something was triggered there and those neurons like this is the answer. So you went from alcohol, cocaine, and what made you go into crystal meth? How was that introduced?
I think I was probably already drunk, and I think I was at a party, and somebody was smoking it, I tried it. You know, I was kind of, I was maybe open-minded to a fault. I didn't, I didn't think there would be anything wrong in trying it. The interesting thing about crystal meth was that the first time I tried it, I did just a little bit of it, and I didn't actually think it had any effect on me until the next morning when I was still wide awake, and I realized, oh, clearly this is having an effect, you know. The second time I tried it, I actually tried it intravenously. And that's a really strange thing because I'm actually afraid of needles. I don't like getting shots. I don't like getting my blood drawn. So if you'd ever told me at any point in my life, at some point you are going to be using drugs regularly intravenously, and you'll be administering them to yourself, I would have said, that's not possible. That will never happen because I am deathly afraid of needles. You know, but I believe what you say about the genetic predisposition. There's I don't know it medically, but I know it experientially. I had an immediate and very strong connection to a reaction to those drugs. And then the other thing is I just feel like I think there may be environmental cofactors, but I think for me, I'm an addict, and it doesn't matter that I went to college. It doesn't matter that I went to graduate school. It doesn't matter. I don't think addiction cares about what kind of family you have or what credentialing is attached to your name. If you're an addict, then exposure to the chemical will produce addiction. And if you're not an addict, then you have a chance of getting away with trying it a couple of times. But you know.
How about the protective factor of pushing that age further and further? You think that helped, that didn't help you?
I don't, well, it didn't help me. I think that there, I don't know, you know, you're speaking about, I can only tell you anecdotally about my life. Mm-hmm. I did not have childhood exposure to drugs. Everything happened to me happened in both a good way and a bad way. Everything that happened to me happened as an adult, and therefore I am completely responsible for it. I, as a fully conscious adult, made every decision responsible for taking me down that path. I can't blame anybody else for it. It wasn't my parents. It didn't have to do with my neighborhood. I don't even think it had to do with any of the whatever traumatic events I may have experienced. I think I allowed myself to make some really bad decisions, you know?
Right. Or maybe that exposure, it's so addicting. Like, I mean, first time you used alcohol, and then, you know, maybe the first, or I would say the first time you used meth, you were hooked, because the second time you used it intravenously.
Yeah. I was always a fairly buttoned up person. I cared a lot about what other people thought. And I always wanted to do things the right way. What alcohol did, and later what drugs did, was it gave me the freedom to be disinhibited. It gave me the freedom not to worry about what other people thought. And that illusion of freedom was really, really powerful for me. And I knew that I didn't want to use drugs, or I didn't want to drink every day, but I did think of it as a sort of periodic safety valve, not safety valve, but yeah, kind of a safety valve. You know, like when the pressure builds up, I could let off a little bit of steam by getting drunk or getting high. What I didn't understand is that that's just a lie that addiction tells you. Like the addicted brain says, you can do it just this one time, it won't hurt. But this one time becomes more and more frequent. And then I can't tell you over the years how many times I said, this is the very last time, I will never do this again. You know, years I told myself that lie. And what's amazing looking back on it is how many times I believed that lie. You know, I believed myself when I gave myself permission to use, like, just this one last time, and it'll be different this time. This time I won't destroy anything. This time I'll make better decisions, when it's not possible for me to make good decisions when I'm drunk and high, you know?
Yeah. Tell us how you ended up in jail. First time.
So the first time I tried drugs for the first time when I was about 35. And so I guess that would have been in 2001. And then I was in prison by 2000. Well, I committed the crime in 2005, and I was in prison in 2006. I was using crystal meth. I was holding on to my job by the skin of my teeth, but my behavior was more and more erratic.
And you were a college professor.
I was. And I'm really embarrassed to say, but I sometimes I didn't show up to work at all. Students would be waiting for me in class and I wouldn't show up. Other times I would show up, but I was not prepared. I wasn't high, but I'd been high. And so I didn't have time to prepare properly. And then I think there were even some times when I showed up to work and I went to work high. And I don't even like, I have so much shame about that. I actually believe that teaching is, it's almost a sacred responsibility. And the fact that I would do that, you know, those parents, they paid money and they trusted that their children would receive a good education. And at least for my part, I did not live up to my end of the bargain. I ultimately obviously had to leave that job. But, you know, the first time all this happened is I didn't understand what was happening to me. It was like I was going down. It was like a mudslide and I was scrambling, trying to grab hold of something to make it stop. But it was just happening too fast and the chemical was too overwhelming. The second
time. Did you realize you had a problem?
There was a lot of denial. I thought I just need to get. Like, I just need to get my feet under me, you know? And I blamed a lot of other people. I blamed anybody that tried to tell me, Ken, something's wrong. I don't know what's going on. Some people even said, Ken, I think you might be doing drugs. I feel like your behavior looks like you're doing drugs. And I got really upset with them. Some friends of mine in my Buddhist community offered to pay for me to go to treatment. And I was so offended. How dare they imply that I would use drugs, you know, and I'll be, it wasn't a calculated response. It was legitimately like my denial was so strong. I just kept thinking it was possible for me to pull it all together, you know? And so then when I crashed and burned, it was a good thing that I crashed and burned, but it was devastating at the same time. I lost my career. I landed in federal prison. My mother had passed away, but my father, you know, he got to be present for all of that. And that breaks my heart. You know, he never imagined that that was not the life he wanted for me, the life of a drug addict. That's just not what he wanted for me. He worked really hard to make sure I didn't have that life. But fortunately, after that, I got clean and sober and I was sober.
Did that happen in jail or after?
So I was arrested and my father was one of the people, my father and his second wife, they had approached me and tried to talk to me about, you know, that we think you're using drugs. So when I got arrested, they facilitated me going into a treatment program. So rather than being held in federal detention, I was allowed to go into a treatment program. So that was my first treatment experience. While I was in there, I became acquainted with self-help recovery support in the community. Even though I did end up having to go to prison on that charge, I had made a lot of connections in the recovering community. And so those people were also really supportive while I was in prison and communicated with me and helped me. So yes, that experience was my first experience in recovery. And I was clean and sober for a little over 9 years at that point.
That's great. And were you able to see that your brain was different and judge yourself differently?
Yeah. Well, it was, I was able to look back and see the history of addiction in my life. I never thought I had a problem with alcohol. I loved alcohol. And I thought alcohol was a great thing in my life. And so even though people would tell me, you know, I had two DUIs, this is before I ever tried doing drugs, right? I had two DUIs. I had friends tell me, Ken, you know, you really change when you're drinking. You think you might have a problem. My response to them was always, I think you have a problem. If you have a problem with my drinking, you don't have to hang out with me. You know, it was never just listening to them and hearing what they had to say. But when I got sober, I was able to look back and see, oh yeah, there is a history of this. And yes, that was, honestly, I was addicted. I am addicted, you know. I guess that was one of the things that was so difficult for me when I relapsed. I relapsed in 2015. And the first time, like I said, it was like a mudslide had happened. And I was just all of a sudden, the ground was crumbling beneath me. The second time it happened.
Before you, you were sober for 9 years, right? Did you feel like you were at risk or you thought, okay, I got this down now?
So in the recovering community, we theoretically, we understand that we're never, you know, we're one drink away from, you know, the distance is not great. It may be 10 years or 20 years of time between our last use, but picking up one time, it's all gone, you know? So we understand it intellectually, but personally, yeah, I felt like it was a thing of the past. It just didn't make any sense to me how that could ever come back into my life again. Really what happened was I forgot what it was like. There were, back in 2003, 2004, I desperately wanted to stop, but I was unable to control the compulsion to use. And I would white knuckle it as long as I could, but eventually I would always succumb. But when I was sober for 9 years, I didn't have a compulsion to use. And I forgot what it was like to feel that way. You know, and even if I thought about it, I could not conjure that state of mind where I was unable to stop using.
And did you go back to teaching?
No, I didn't. I had my second career was in social services. I worked with mentally ill homeless adults. I was a vocational rehabilitation specialist. I worked in a program at UCSD that worked with people coming out of jail who were HIV positive. And I was also a case manager for people newly infected with hepatitis C. Mostly people newly infected with hepatitis C are mostly intravenous drug users. Not exclusively, but that was a lot of the cases. It's interesting because I was a provider of services that I would then come to need, you know.
So you think that you would know better, right? You're
well, that's a
with
huge
a community
part of my shame.
That yeah. has that. I don't know if it's shame or it's you know, a tendency, right? A genetic predisposition, a risk.
Well, I when I said the word shame, I meant that a huge part of the shame after I relapsed was that I know better. Like everything.
So what do you think happened that you know better that made you?
There is in my brain, once I start using, it doesn't matter what I know and understand.
You're hijacked. Your brain's hijacked.
It literally is. I try to explain it to people. It felt like I was the conductor of a train and the brakes don't work. And I see very clearly that I am going off the rails and I'm going to go off the side of a mountain and I can't do anything about it. And I'm just helpless, but I'm still the guy in charge. You know, I'm sitting there in the control booth, unable to change the direction I'm hurtling on. But that is, it's also, there's a tremendous amount of shame in that. And I think that shame fueled the relapse. Like it is hard feeling like I'm nothing but a disappointment to people. It's hard to feel like all I do is hurt the people who care about me and love me. And they would have so much hope every time I would, I tried so hard. I relapsed in 2015 and I wound up on the streets in 2017. In those 2 years, I was in so many different treatment programs. I did everything I knew how to do to get clean and sober. And then when I would relapse, the look on people's faces. I mean, they care about me. They love me. Nobody wants to see that. One of my closest friends, he said, he actually had to ask, I'm sitting in the front row watching this and I can't watch this. I can't watch this. So he asked, like, you know, please don't get in touch with me until you're sober. But I can't see this. You know, I love you too much.
That's painful.
It is painful.
And so what triggered, or is that the right word, that had you go back again after 9 years?
There's a couple of things. One is I had changed jobs. I'd actually gotten into an MFA program, Master's in Fine Arts program at UCSD in writing. And so I left social services, started a new job. And at that point, I was about 50. 50 years old. And it's a scary thing to give up full-time work with retirement benefits, with health insurance, to give all that up on the hopes that this new path might lead to something. But I wasn't really being honest with myself, with other people, how scared that made me, you know? So there was that level of, I made a pretty big life change. I had a lot of emotions around that life change. I wasn't talking about those emotions. And the other thing is, I have a history of sexual compulsivity. And I don't want to get into it too much, but that is connected to my crystal meth use, a huge amount. The first sign of relapse was that the entire time I'd been sober, I had not acted out on my sexual compulsive behavior, because I recognized from my past that there's a connection. So if I want to stay chemically abstinent, I need to be very careful about my sexual behavior. But the first thing that started happening was I gave myself permission to act out on some of my sexual compulsions. And then that led to drug use, because it's just such a strong tie to me.
I was wondering if COVID had anything to do that, or was that before?
This is well before. This was 2015. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then that's it. Once you try one thing, your brain's hijacked.
Yeah. The other thing that happened was I had spent most of the previous, 8 or 9 years well connected to a lot of people who were in recovery. Because of that career change, I just stopped spending as much time with them. I stopped doing all of the things that were part of my normal routine to stay clean and sober. All of that fell out because I felt too busy. I felt like I just had too much going on. I didn't have time to do all that. And I just took for granted, I don't need to worry about that part of my life because I'm good. Like, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to use drugs. I don't feel like doing those things. That will never happen to me. So I just, all of the things that I had become practiced in doing to keep myself clean and sober, I stopped doing those things. And for those of us in recovery, we know that that's a huge warning sign. When somebody stops doing those things, that's
a problem.
Yeah.
And so, Ken, you're so open and intimate with the struggles that you've had. Is your recovery, is that therapeutic for you to come to share that? Are you trying to help other people by doing that?
Well, yes, absolutely. I usually prefer to do it one-on-one. Because, there are people who probably have gone through some of the same things I have. And if I can share something to communicate that I understand what they're going through, I want to. I was just surprised by some of your questions, and I didn't know how to answer them without being, I didn't want to lie to you, but at the same time, I didn't expect to disclose some of the things that I've disclosed with you.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I don't think I've said too much. I've tried to be careful. I don't want to, I don't want to say anything that would be disturbing to the listeners. And at the same time, it's personal stuff. I want to share what's necessary for you to understand what I've been through.
Share only what you want to share, you're comfortable with, please. Yeah. What I've heard you said, and you did a beautiful piece for Voices of Hope, where you say, people don't understand what addiction is like, and you're able to describe that. So I'm like, oh, well, I really want chocolate. I love chocolate. It's hard for me to be away from chocolate. Is it the same thing? Or tell us, what does it feel? What do people not understand what addiction is like?
I don't remember what I said in that interview. For me, the desire to use crystal meth, it's not a craving, like you were saying, a craving for chocolate. Sometimes I crave chocolate. Sometimes I crave fried chicken. I love that. But if I don't get it, I'm okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's okay if I don't get chocolate. When a craving for crystal meth is a compulsion that's so deep, it feels like my life is on the line. It feels like I'm going to crawl out of my skin if I don't get it. To me, there's not the word craving doesn't even begin. It's the same word in both cases, but it's not the same emotion or the same physiological thing.
The way we describe it medically and chemically is that you need dopamine, like you need water and air to breathe. And if you don't have it, you feel like you're going to die.
Yeah.
And you're going to do whatever it takes to get it.
Yeah.
Right.
The images in movies, sometimes you see a rat scrabbling against a cage, desperate to try to get out, desperately looking for something. That's what I felt like so often, especially when I couldn't get, like, either I didn't have the money or I was in a context where I couldn't get it. And I just felt desperate, like I had to figure out a way to get it. Beyond reason, it really, like you said earlier, the word hijacked, that's a great word. It felt like my brain was hijacked. And I know that I am the addict, but it did feel like this external thing was inhabiting my brain and forcing me to do things against my will.
Yeah. It's interesting that you call yourself an addict, but the medical community is taught, don't use that word.
Okay.
It's a person with a substance use disorder, because it stigmatizes you to call you an addict. What do you think? Or does it matter? It's like, you're who you are. You could call yourself whatever you want to call yourself.
I understand the stigma, and I appreciate that medical professionals are sensitive to that. I think that the way a lot of people use the word addict, it's like, it's the same thing as saying you're disgusting. Oh, you're an addict, you know? But for me, I need to claim that part of myself, because it's the truth. It's just the truth. I am addicted to, I whether we say I'm addicted or I have this substance use disorder, the fact is I have it. And that at least at this moment in time, the only way I can treat it is by not using alcohol and drugs. I don't think medical science is in a position to give me the ability to have a glass of wine with dinner. Maybe other people can do that, even other people who identify as addicts, but I'm not one of them. I would worry that if I have one glass of wine, I'll probably have more. And if I have more, I'll probably be disinhibited enough to allow myself to use crystal meth. And so I can't even open the door. I can't take the risk, because the consequences for me are way too severe. At this point, if I use, I know that I face severe legal consequences. I'm still on probation. I also know that I face severe personal emotional consequences. I have destroyed so much that's important to me in my life through my addiction. I don't want to pick up again. So if I were to, it would be like me destroying everything all over again. So just even the legal consequences notwithstanding, for me personally, it's too important for me to protect my integrity and to protect what I love in my life by staying away from these chemicals.
Yeah. So you hit Skid Row of San Diego. You call it the heart of darkness. What is it like to be there?
Yeah, it's the you're referring to the bottoms.
The bottoms.
Yeah. I've written about it, and so I didn't know that you had read any of that. But yeah, it's well, thank you. I appreciate that. So yeah, I call it the heart of darkness. There are a lot of well, first of all, let me say that it hurts my heart to see homelessness the way it's talked about on the news a lot right now.
What do you mean by that?
There's a kind of a sense of, well, first of all, like, you know, in political terms, it's just a political football. People are pointing to homelessness as evidence of an increasing crime wave, and they want to use that as ammunition against politicians they don't like. And I think that that's using, that's the problem of homelessness exists regardless, it has existed and it has been a real problem regardless of which party is in power. And it's true in red states and blue states. So I don't like that it's used as political football. It hurts my heart, because what we're talking about are human beings' lives. And I don't think that that should be a political issue. Especially the stigmatizing of them should not be a way to score political points.
Of the people. But we do have a record number of homeless, and 50% of all the unsheltered human beings in the United States live in Southern California.
Yeah. Yeah. And that there's a lot of reasons for that. And one of them is the weather, you know. It is, I don't know why I ended up there. I know that I was in my third or fourth rehab, and one of my dearest friends, and I was doing well, I'd been there for a few months. And one of my dearest friends, we were in a family group, and she was talking about how she was so proud of me. And that she, and she said that she hadn't seen the light in my eyes in such a long time, and the light was back. And then for some reason, all I could think of is, all you do is hurt people. All you do is disappoint people. And all you are is a homeless drug addict. And so that night after she left and after the group was over, I left treatment. I walked out of there and I went downtown and I stayed there for the next 3 years. Initially it felt, I wanted all of my friends to just forget about me. I thought it was better if they just wrote me off as dead. That way I was not disappointing anybody anymore, because I had tried to get sober and I couldn't. And I tried to get sober and I couldn't. And I was just tired of that. And what's it like on the streets? You know, what's interesting is that there are so many different reasons why people are out there, but addiction is a huge part of it. You know, there are people from, there are young people there in their 30s who are from other parts of the country who came to California to go to rehab, and then relapsed and then wound up on the streets of downtown San Diego.
I know, I met them.
Yeah, and then there are people who are who hit tragedy late in life, you know, and they had, you know, they used to have a home and a business in El Cajon, but now they're homeless downtown, and it's some combination of life tragedy and substance abuse, you know. And so there's so many different stories and so many different reasons, but mental illness and drugs are two of the biggest ones, I think.
People who are, they say, who are on the streets, especially, you know, Southern California, you need to be on methadone to keep awake so people don't steal your things. That's what I hear.
Well, sure. It's savage on the streets. So for me, I'm an intravenous drug user, and I shot up several times a day, and I did it for a lot of reasons. Sometimes when I'm cold and when I'm hungry, crystal meth, like I'm not hungry when I'm high. That's just part of what the stimulant does. I have no sense. Which is why I'm so hungry, because I've been high for several days, so I haven't eaten for several days. Then when I begin to come down, I'm famished. But if I don't have access to food, then really it's much easier to shoot up. When it's 3 a.m. in the weather we've been having, if I'm outside and I'm cold, crystal meth will warm me up. When I'm coming down off the drugs and I'm able to think a little bit clearly, and I see how I'm living on the streets, I see how I'm making money, I'm shoplifting, I'm going through garbage cans, I'm doing these things. And I think about all of the things I've lost. I feel suicidal. And so crystal meth actually gets me out of that feeling in a strange way. You know, even though it's the thing that caused all of it, in that moment, I stop. I can't look honestly at what I've done to my life. I can't look at that, and it's too much.
It's interesting, because we see patients in the emergency department with the term methicidal, who are high on meth and suicidal. And when they come down and get their brain back, they're not suicidal, but you're saying it's the opposite.
Well, I've seen it both ways. I know people that
I can see it both ways.
Yeah. For me, I knew that So I didn't do heroin. I like I told you before, I don't like it. I don't like, and I've tried it on the streets. It's such a common drug. So I've tried it because the people I was with were doing it. But I have, I don't like it. But on the streets, it was pretty much a daily occurrence that somebody would OD, or more than one person would OD. Now, on the streets, an OD doesn't necessarily mean death. Sometimes we successfully bring that person back with Narcan or just whatever we have to do to bring them back from
did you death. Ever overdose?
There was one time it was with heroin. It wasn't very much heroin, and I was with somebody, and I came to with them, like they were actually punching me, physically punching me, and they said my lips were turning blue. I wound up in the emergency room twice, both times I have no memory of how I got there. I don't know if I don't know what the situation was. No. I was found in one case. I was passed out, and an ambulance came and took me to the emergency room. And in another case, I was wandering, incoherent, and unresponsive to people, and so they called 911. And then I just woke up and I was in the emergency room. And the last memory I had was I was at a trolley station waiting for a trolley or something like that.
How were you treated? And maybe I should be afraid to ask you, but how were you treated in the emergency department?
They were very good to me. They were good to me. In both cases, I think I misspoke. In neither case did I wake up in the emergency room. The first time I woke up in the emergency room and they were asking me what year it was and who's president. I remember just thinking, what a ridiculous, well, who's president? Why are you asking me that? You know, the second time I woke up in a room, I had been admitted, and I woke up and then the nurse came in and she goes, oh, look who's awake. And she was very sweet, very sweet. Oh. And she's the one that told me what had happened because I had honestly no idea. I didn't, you know.
I was intrigued what you said about living on the streets and that the community actually doesn't want to call 911. As an emergency physician, it's like, oh, they're calling us all the time. But is there a culture of trying not to call the ambulance? Sure.
Oh, absolutely. At least on the bottoms, when you call 911, theoretically, there's a worry that if an ambulance comes, police will come.
Still to this day,
there's that. But on the other hand, the fact is, if somebody's life is in danger, you know. But basically, the rule is, if you're going to call 911, make sure everybody knows. Nobody wants to be surprised by a police car pulling up on you. So you let people know, like, we're about to call 911 or we're calling 911. And then anybody that doesn't want to be in the area just scatters. But you make sure it's known. And also sometimes you know for a fact that the person who you're trying to resuscitate doesn't want you to call 911 for whatever reason, even though they're unconscious or whatever. But you have to weigh that too. You have to weigh, like, they're going to be really mad. You know, you're dealing with people who are, there's not a lot going on in their lives. They don't, you know, they're basically living to get high. And so they don't want to go to jail or prison, but they probably, in some cases, they might well have a warrant over their heads. So they know that if the ambulance comes, at any point the police check their ID, there will be a warrant and they'll be put in handcuffs. And they don't want that. At the same time, if you're there and you're seeing somebody who you know is dying and you can't resuscitate them, then you don't have a choice. The other thing, though, too, is there are examples of people who one person had OD'd on heroin, and they called 911, and the ambulance was, the ambulance driver got out of the ambulance and was doing something. And so even though the person was ready to go to the hospital, the ambulance driver wasn't And so it took a couple of minutes for the ambulance to leave. And in an overdose situation, a couple of minutes is everything. And so that person ended up dying. And the feeling was, you know, sometimes it feels, and I understand it, but the feeling is our lives matter less to the EMTs. Like if this had been Rancho Bernardo, there's no question that the person would have been immediately whisked to an emergency room. But because it's somebody on the streets, I've seen situations where I knew somebody that we called 911 because he asked that we call 911 because he was having an asthma attack, and they wouldn't take him to the hospital. Because I know that there's a perception in a lot of, and it might even be true. I'm not saying it's not a fair perception, but that there's a lot of med seeking behavior.
Or shelter seeking, or just, right, exactly. I just want a sandwich or a place to sleep.
Right. And I'm not going to say nobody does that. I'm going to say, I know that some people have done that, especially on a really cold night or a rainy night. Mm-hmm. I know people have done it. But I know that, most of the people that I knew avoid that, just because they don't like the way that they're treated in those situations. And, medical help is a last resort. But on the other hand, when you're talking about thousands of homeless people, you know, 10 who do is enough to cause a problem in an emergency room. You know, 10 who are going there just to like be inside from the cold, you know.
I read you talk about feeling like the human Kleenex was your analogy.
Well, disposable.
Oh, so sad, disposable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing is, you know, at this point, because of my experience, when I look at homeless people, you know, I have met people who were like me, college professors. I knew a woman who was a minister. She had been clean off of drugs for 20 or 30 years when she relapsed. And so even though she's on the streets with us, she's still trying to tell people about that they are a child of God. She's still trying to do what she understands is the right thing to do. Yeah. And at the same time, that woman, she ultimately died of an overdose, but she came close to dying on many occasions. And, you know, it's such a disconnect. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been in a conversation with one or two other people who also were sober for several years. And so we're getting high together, but we're talking about recovery, which is such a strange thing. Or people talking about like the children that they're not in touch with, the sister they're not in touch with, but they're talking about the memories they have of them. And so when I see homeless people, I don't see like dirty, unwashed, criminal, bike thief, shoplifter. I don't see that. What I see is somebody's son, somebody's daughter, somebody's father, somebody who used to be a lawyer, somebody who used to be a construction worker, somebody who, you know what I mean? Like a whole life, and that there's a reason they're there on the streets at that moment. But when they're just homeless, then all of that gets erased and they're just a walking pathology.
How do you recommend us who are not homeless and we're running into people on the street who are homeless, how should we act?
I don't know.
Should we give money? Should we?
Honestly, this is the social service provider in me. Yeah. I think it is probably wiser for you to give money to service agencies that support them. Mm-hmm. I am aware that if I give somebody money, that money may or may not go directly to buy alcohol or drugs, but indirectly it will, you know. And I know that when people tried to help me in that way, you know, I also know that people were kind. I remember people giving me food when I was really hungry. I remember people asking me if I was thirsty and buying me a bottle of water on a really hot day. And these were people who had no reason. They had no reason to be kind to me. But they were being very kind to me. And I do think that those moments reminded me of my humanity I think anything that you do to remind, you know, and it doesn't have to be an act of kindness. I think sometimes just looking somebody in their eye, you know, I like when, if a homeless person asks me for money now, I look them in the eye and I say, no, I don't have any cash. But I look them in the eye. I don't ignore them as though they didn't even exist. I don't know.
Is there fear? Like sometimes there's fear of meeting somebody who's homeless or making that eye contact, like maybe I'm going to get robbed or hurt or something. Or
sure. Sure. Yeah. And I don't. So desperate people do desperate things. So I'm not going to say it never happens. Yeah. I'm going to say in general, most homeless people are trying to avoid trouble. And they're not going to attack a person on the street. On the other hand, sometimes somebody might be in psychosis, and that's a different thing entirely. I understand. I am not going to presume to tell somebody else how to interact with a homeless person. I think in that situation, just be realistic, you know, homeless people. I just don't want people to forget that what we're talking about are actual human beings, you know? And then, you know,
I think that's the best message.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody's different. Every situation's different. You may be in danger. There may be psychosis. You may have to protect yourself. Things have happened, but there is a human being behind that. All of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were a social worker. You ended up in the bottom on Skid Row and then in jail. What, I don't know if you wanted to, again, please disclose only what you want to disclose, but how did you end up in jail and how did you get out and what was that like?
So I got into I was going in and out of county jail pretty regularly. There's all kinds of, was arrested for possession and sales. I was unable to comply with the terms of probation. And so when you don't comply with probation, there's a warrant over, you get a warrant. And so I lived under a warrant most of the time I was on the streets. So I was going in and out of jail a lot. And then to survive, I was, you know, I one night it was raining and I slept in a parking garage. And the next morning, it was a City College parking garage. So the San Diego police patrolled the parking garage and they stopped me and they, you know, and I got a ticket for trespassing. And then they also took me in because I had a warrant. And that's just a normal occurrence. That's the reason why, a lot of homeless people will do anything to avoid police contact. But COVID happened. It's actually the timing is for me was especially difficult. Was actually trying to get into, I was on a waiting list for two different treatment programs, two of the county funded treatment programs or Medi-Cal funded. And they both had long waiting lists. And then, I was also trying to get into, a transitional housing program for homeless people. Because I knew that my life on the streets was not sustainable. If I continued on the streets, I wanted to die. I just didn't know if I had it in me to get sober again. And then COVID happened. And then all of a sudden, I think people might not remember the early days of COVID when everything shut down, like just essential services. And so treatment programs weren't taking in new people. People were afraid of, you know, people were afraid of homeless people because we were on the streets. And so they really, like, I would approach a treatment program and literally people would back up because they wanted to maintain a distance, you know. And so in that context, I felt really desperate. Like the resources that used to be available to me were no longer available. It was difficult to do anything, even the places that used to provide meals, some of them closed. I wound up going to Mexico and I started bringing drugs over across the border. Other people did that. That it's something that homeless people get recruited to do. I didn't know that before, but it's it's just, you know, and that's where I felt really the most disposable. Like, they didn't care about us. To them, we were just worthless junkies. And we acted like that. You know what I mean? Like, we were, I put my life at great risk just for free dope and a little bit of cash. And I did that willingly. And so I guess I was acting like a worthless junkie, you know, but later, you know, and so to them, it's, you know, the amount of drugs I was carrying across the border means nothing to the people I was working for, but it was enough to, I could have served a very long time in prison because of that. I could have served 10 or 20 years in prison because of that. I'm very fortunate that the judge took a broader view of my life. And looked not just at the crime, but at the totality of my life. And so he gave me a 30-month sentence, 2.5 years. But he was well within the sentencing guideline range to give me, if he'd given me 15 years, that nobody would have raised an eyebrow at that.
And then while in prison, did you get your brain back? I call it from being hijacked. You get your brain back.
It's interesting you put it that way. No surprise to you, I'm sure, but there are drugs and alcohol in prisons, in county jail, in prisons. And I hope I'm not, getting anybody in trouble, but
everybody knows. alcohol too. I thought it was more drugs.
There's both. Alcohol is not that alcohol ferments naturally. So, it's possible to, a clever enough person can figure out how to manufacture alcohol and can make alcohol, you know. But yeah, so there's both. I personally don't like getting high when I'm locked up. I don't enjoy it. So the entire time I was using, the only time I wouldn't be high would be in when I was locked up. There were drugs available to me, and I even knew people who had drugs who were willing to provide them to me, but I always said no. And part of it was because I don't like being high in prison, but the other part was just, if there's no last time, there's no last time. You know, I needed there. But what happened to me when you say it gave time, I feel like it gave my brain time to heal. I was in prison for a little over 2 years. I think when I was in county jail, it would be anywhere from a few days to a few weeks, maybe a couple of months. But I don't think that was enough time. More than one occasion, I would leave county jail with every intention of going into treatment or doing the right thing. And then within an hour being high. Mm-hmm. And my fear in prison was that the same thing was going to happen again. I was deathly afraid that when I left prison and had the opportunity to get high again, I would. And I was very afraid of it. But I think when we talk about, we talked earlier about the hijacking of the brain, I do feel like that the drugs actually damaged parts of the physical organ. Now, I'm not talking about my thinking. I'm talking about my brain itself. You know, parts were damaged. And the part that felt the most damage was the part that's able to make the part that's sort of the executive functioning, I guess, the part that makes good
decisions.
It's
like you read the textbook.
Yeah. Well, but it's also because that's what it felt like. It felt like I could tell myself, do not do this for this, and this reason. I was very clear why I shouldn't do what I was doing, but I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't talk myself out of doing it, you know? So that part of the brain had to get stronger. And I feel like because I was in prison, long enough, you know, that part of the brain had time to heal. The other thing is, when I was on the streets, even though I chose to go on the streets, I deliberately went there and wanted everybody in my life to write me off as dead. After a while, it felt like everybody had abandoned me and nobody cared what had happened to me. And I had a lot of friends and a lot of people I loved. And so I felt very abandoned. So when I got to prison and I started reaching out to people, I found out that like they hadn't forgotten me. Many of them had actually gone downtown and looked for me, which broke my heart. Some of them were actually quite angry with me. only because they thought they had heard I had died. And so it was really nobody abandoned me. I abandoned them. And that for some reason allowed, it was a real shift in perspective. When for me anyway, it matters to see how I was responsible for a lot of stuff that happened to me, because it puts me back in the driver's seat in a weird way. Like my choices, my actions, my thinking. And so I can begin to change those things. You know, I don't know what would have happened had I been sentenced to, let's say, 15 years in prison. I know that I was 55 at the time I was sentenced. And so the idea of starting over at 70 was terrifying. And I am profoundly grateful to the judge who gave me 30 months, because that was, it felt like it was a fair sentence. I broke the law. I broke the law and I did it knowingly. You know, I don't deserve to just, I don't think I should just walk away from that. You know, I should pay a price for my decision, but I don't know that my life should be over because of that decision. That 30 month sentence was enough. It was just punishment. It helped my brain to heal, but it wasn't too much. I think if it was too much at 70, I don't know what I would think. If I didn't feel like I had any hope left, I don't know what I would have done. But when I got out, I was 56 years old. And it's hard to rebuild my life at 56, but it's not impossible. The way I look at it, I've got another 15 or 20 years of a good working life left. And from the time I was 20 to the time I was 40, I did a lot. So from the time I'm 55 to the time I'm 75, I can do a lot. So I intend to do a lot. You know what I mean? The good thing about getting sober at this age is I don't feel like I've got time to waste. I'm not a young man. When I was young, I would always say, I'll do that later. I can do that later. Now, there is no more later. Like, if I'm going to write, I have to write now. If I want to develop a career in theater, then I have to do it now. And I can't worry about, you know, there is no later. You know, I'm alive now. I'm healthy now. I have the opportunity now. So do it now.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Sounds like you got your executive functioning part of your brain back.
Yeah.
You know, if you do PET scans on brains with people who are using chronic intravenous methamphetamine, you see the hole physically. You see the holes in those brains. But the hope is that if you stop, you can get it back. So that's good.
Yeah.
And then the heart issues. I'm surprised that if you used a lot of methamphetamines, that didn't give you some heart condition, because that's huge.
It's funny you say that. I was released from federal custody on August 2nd of 2022, 6 months ago. And on August 4th, I had an aortic dissection.
My God, Ken.
Yeah, my aorta tore. And I was actually in the ICU for 2 weeks. Because they just couldn't bring my blood pressure down. They couldn't, and I had to have a stent put in, an aortic repair. They put a, you know all about that. But
that's,
they did that.
That's a huge deal.
It was, yeah. So no, and the interesting thing was, it was clear to me yet again, like, you know, there are consequences to the choices I made.
Wow. You know? And now you're living life to its fullest, but something else special happened to you while you were in prison and you didn't even know it.
Right. well, I had wanted to be a writer for a long time. And when I was in prison, being in prison was like, for the first time, I wasn't on chemicals. And then a few weeks went by, a month went by, 2 months went by. And I couldn't stop thinking, like, how did I get here? Like, and I thought a lot about my parents, my childhood, my life. There's no way that I start out there and I end up in a federal prison for the second time after being on the streets for 3 years. How does that happen? You know, and then also, like, I would just have these, I don't know if they were PTSD flashbacks, but very, very intense, vivid visceral feelings about being on the streets. And then these very vivid dreams. And the only way I could handle them was I would write them down. Writing them down, they became the basis of the these prose poems that I wrote. And I submitted some writing to the Pen America. They have a prison writing program. And it's a contest for writers in prison. One of my good friends told me about that. She suggested I submit my work, and I submitted it, but I didn't hear anything back. For over a year, I did not hear a word from them. And then when I got out, I was notified that I had won in, I actually won in two categories, in fiction and in nonfiction essay. And then since then, some of my work was published in an anthology they produced, but it's also been published elsewhere. And I've been working and submitting my work to places. So, yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you are the professor.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's pretty wonderful. So when you look back and you share this really heart-wrenching personal story, and you've given us such a amazing picture of what it is to be addicted, to have an addiction, and what that feels like, even though you know better. When you look back, you're moving forward in a beautiful way, doing creative, good, healthy things. And I've heard you say something, how you look back, it's like you're ashamed of those things, but you're more than that as a human being, right? Yeah. You're more than that than just having used meth or being someone with addiction.
Yeah. I'm glad that the judge took the fact that I was a college professor, and that I'd worked in social services, and that I volunteered extensively in the community, and that I was involved. He took all of that into account. Mm-hmm. And I think every single homeless person is a whole human being who has been a lot more to a lot of people besides just the drug addict, criminal person that is right there in front of you. And so that's, I guess, one of the reasons why I feel like it's important to think about the human beings involved and not just the pathologies involved, not just the mental illness or the substance use disorder. For me, what you talk about, I'm not proud of what I've done. I'm proud of many of the things I've done, but I'm not proud of the worst of my decisions, but I'm done being ashamed of it. At least for me, shame keeps me in my addiction. When I feel like I am worthless and that I have nothing to contribute and all I do is hurt people, then that's an excuse to use. When I feel like I have something to contribute, that's a reason to live. And to me, that's the opposition. I can be alive and use, but that's not being alive. Or I can really live life and connect to people and contribute to the world and do something I can be proud of. But I can't do that high. I can't.
I think that's what really touched me when I heard you speak, is that you're able to see yourself as more than just that, the parts that you are ashamed of. Yes, you're ashamed of that. Talk to me and many other people, I think, because we all have things in our lives that we're not proud of, that we're ashamed of, that we're angry at ourselves with. But you were able to forgive yourself for things that are not so great and move on. And so all the more for the rest of anybody you meet, who we all have things that we're not proud of or ashamed of, or, we would have done differently. And I would just hope we could all forgive ourselves like you've been able to forgive yourself.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I don't know if forgive is, I know that we're supposed to forgive ourselves. I don't know if I have.
Or see yourselves more than that, you think? Or
I have compassion for myself. Like, I think I did some terrible things, and but I know that I wouldn't do those things sober, and that's not who I am. I have some compassion for the person. I'm not proud that I brought drugs in from Mexico into the United States. I knew that what I was doing was bringing something in that destroys lives. It destroyed my life. You know what I mean? I didn't think I was doing anybody any favors, but I can beat myself up about that. And I do sometimes. Or I can say, yeah, but you were not in your right mind. you were, I made decisions I would never make now, you know? And I guess
and
that's,
you're more than that one snapshot of your life, right? Yeah. There's more to you.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Well, and I appreciate your compassion too. That's, I appreciate it a lot. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I like to talk to you and learn from you because I see patients like you were in the emergency department. I want to be able to relate and be a better doctor for it. Yeah. So I think that you helped me. I appreciate
thank
that.
You. Thank you. I listened to your podcast. I appreciate the level of expertise, not only that you bring, but that the guests bring. And so that's why I was really surprised when, because I, you know, I have no expertise at all. I just know what I went through, but really I can't even speak for other homeless people.
But that's it. They say, who is wise? Someone who learns from everyone. So we have to learn from everyone.
Yes. Right? I guess you're very wise. Yeah.
I want to look for you, as you've heard with my podcast, I want you to give advice. I think you have a lot of advice to give about, to different groups of people. So what would you say, Ken, to other people who are struggling with alcohol, with methamphetamine, or whatever? What's your advice to that group from what you've gone through?
I know how much it hurts to be addicted. And I would encourage them not to be so hard on themselves. I don't know how to put this. My experience in addiction was everybody telling me that, this may not have been the words they used, but what I heard was, you're bad and you're wrong. And it's true, the behavior is bad and wrong, but it's not who I am and it's not who I have to be. And so I have to start from that place. And so approach recovery with a sense of hope and love for yourself. I guess that's my advice. You can't get sober or clean by telling yourself what a bad person you are. You have to look at, what do I have to offer the world? What do I want to contribute to the world? And then remember that the only way you can do that is by being clean and sober. I think there's a positive way to approach recovery. And I think punitive ways don't, at least for this addict, they don't help, you know?
That's beautiful. And what would be your advice to friends and family?
Don't take it personally. I appreciate the friends and family in my life who loved me, but did not enable me. I think people that, I didn't have anybody in my life who was willing to just give me money. But I think that's the worst thing you can do to an addict is just keep giving them money. Cause money is, you know, but people who kept telling, who insisted on believing me contrary to all evidence, I really appreciate them. People who insisted that they know the real me and that this is not the real me. And they kept telling me that even though I didn't believe it, until I got to a place where I could hear that, you know? But that's what I would say to the people who love an addict is, believe in that person and love them, but, don't help them get high.
Yeah, that's good advice. And finally, what's your advice to healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, me, my colleagues? How should we do better, approach you better, understand?
I can't even presume to give. Many of you have saved my life on more than one occasion, and I'm grateful to you. I have. I also felt at times, sometimes that some of you, in the stress and the demands of your job, may have been, it felt a little bit unkind because I was just a homeless person. But I would never, I don't have your job and I can't even imagine how difficult your job is. You know, I would never presume to give you guys advice. Thank you for saving my life on those times when you did, more than one occasion, my life was saved. And In that case, it really didn't matter if the person was dealing with a college professor or with a homeless drug addict. They were saving the life of a human being, and I appreciate that. So,
and yeah, so I when I talk to patients, sometimes I tell them exactly what you say, and it's like, this is not you. Okay, this is not you. You need to get your brain back. Try, if you can get off the alcohol, drugs, whatever, then you'll see who you are. But right now, this is not you. You cannot, your brain's hijacked.
Yeah.
And I feel like they open up their eyes and listen when they say that, when I say that.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. We're not always willing to hear, you know, and a lot of people die in addiction, either from overdose or from chronic health problems that develop. And, you know, I wish I understood why some of us get clean and some of us don't. I really don't know why. I wish I understood. And I wish I could help other people do it, you know.
So usually I begin the podcast with the question from our audience. I'm going to end now with a question from audience, and it's from one of our nurses, Lisa Wallace, and she asks, is there hope? And she, you know what kind of environment she works in, I work in. There, we see people with really severe substance use disorder. Is there hope for this people? And I guess you're one of them.
Yeah, 100% there's hope. I think as long as people are alive, there's hope. If I had died, once we're dead, that's the end of the story. And I was close to death on many occasions, and I wanted to die on many occasions. But as long as we're alive, there's hope. The healthcare workers who helped me in those various emergency settings that I had to, where I needed help. I don't know who they thought they were helping. If they saw a homeless person and they were just helping them, I don't know if they have any idea that's. I don't know if any of them will hear this podcast and know that today I'm a different person, that I'm living differently today. I hope they do, and I hope that I have no idea how they could ever make the connection between that person and this person. But maybe her name was Lisa. Maybe Lisa was one of the people who helped me.
And there's a lot of people that we see like you, so you kind of represent all of them, you know. Yeah.
For what it's worth, I'm Facebook friends with some people that I knew from the streets, who are clean, and some are clean longer than me, you know, 3 years, 5 years, you know. So people who land on the streets, they don't have to stay there. You know, it's possible. And I know a lot of people who are on the streets still, and I'm grateful that I know a lot of people who are leading productive lives and are proud of themselves for what they're doing today. Yeah.
That's great. So I think, can you bring us all hope and show faith, never give up. We have hope. For me, it'd be like, I have hope for every single patient. Even if it's frustrating, and even if you say like some people don't listen, thank you for saying that, because we sometimes feel like a failure, like we're not able to do something. So we could just like not give up and still be kind and still have hope. And I love how you see yourself as someone who never gave up on themselves, and you're more than the addiction that you had.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Webb. Thank you for what you do too. I think, one of the messages that you give, at least I feel like I hear from you, is that no one approach is sufficient. This problem is bigger than any single approach, and that everybody needs to do their part, whether it's law enforcement, healthcare, treatment, harm reduction, social services, every single person, friends, caregivers, everybody has a part to play. And I guess addicts have a part to play too. Like we have our role to play as well. And that's, we need to take care of getting our lives back, you know? But I love that message too, because it puts us all on the same team. We're not fighting each other. You know, it's not, the addicts against the police. But this is a terrible thing that's happening, and families are being destroyed, lives are being destroyed, communities are being destroyed. Nobody wants that.
So I want to say thank you to Lisa Wallace, nurse extraordinaire. I have seen the greatest amount of empathy and compassion to patients and colleagues and personal struggles over the years that we've had. Lisa, you inspire me. Thank you for your question, and thank you for your heart. And thank you, Ken Saragosa, for sharing your intimate stories, struggles, and giving us all a lot of hope. And I wish for you and your friends and your family health, physical health, mental health, substance use disorder health. And so thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaac1.org, that's ISIC1.org, to view their library that translates medical journals for public understanding, listen to their speaker series, and follow the science on marijuana. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Oneet Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.